Welcome to Women Who Lead. I'm Ann Thomas. On this edition of Women Who Lead, you'll meet three women doing important work, not only in the state of Michigan, but around the country as well. Angie Kelly, Ernst & Young's first female managing partner in Detroit. Tina Kozak, the new owner and CEO of Franco, a leading communications agency in Michigan. And Barbara McQuaid, the former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and University of Michigan Law School professor. She's got a new book out. It's called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. An interesting and informative show coming up right after these messages. Welcome to Women Who Lead. I'm Ann Thomas. In 2018, Angie Kelly became the first female managing partner of Ernst & Young LLP, also known as EY in Detroit. And today, Angie is one of our 2024 Women Who Lead honorees. Angie, congratulations and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
So, Angie, talk a little bit about your fabulous career. You've been in charge now since 2018, but kind of give us some background about you.
Sure, thanks. So a little bit about me. I moved several times growing up, but always found my way back to Michigan, and I'm very proud to live and work in the Detroit area and have our office in the heart of Detroit in Campus Martius downtown. I'm a Spartan. I've received an accounting degree from Michigan State and then started with my career at Ernst & Young over 25 years ago as an intern, and started full-time after I graduated and became a certified public accountant or CPA. And as you said, Ernst & Young, or as we're known by EY, is one of the largest professional service firms in the world. We have approximately 400,000 professionals across the globe. And the access and opportunities within the firm are boundless. As a student, I never had really been exposed to a career in professional services, and I loved the variety of opportunities and exposure that it would provide me and continues to today. I've had a chance to travel the world and work directly with business leaders from both small startup companies as well as very large global public companies on some of their most pressing business challenges, and has served a number of roles throughout my career. But as you mentioned, about 5 years ago, was honored to be named Detroit Office Managing Partner and lead our Detroit office practice now of about 800 assurance, consulting, strategy and transaction, and tax professionals. And I'm a strong supporter in the community, serve on a number of boards, and have here for a number of years, as well as a big advocate for entrepreneurs and love working closely with entrepreneurs.
Angie, when you say professional services, explain to our listeners what that means.
So I'm an accountant by background, a certified professional accountant or RCA, but we have a number of services that we serve our clients throughout the globe, but here, especially in our Michigan market, we have, accounting, consulting, strategy and transaction, and all kinds of different tax services that we provide for individuals and companies of all sizes.
In your work, what have been some of your proudest moments?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm an advocate of entrepreneurs, and I previously led our EY Entrepreneur of the Year program. Mm-hmm. We actually worked very closely with WJR for many, many years on this, highlighting business leaders and family businesses that are driving growth and creating jobs in our region. I'm also an executive sponsor for two other business accelerator programs, our Entrepreneurial Winning Women program, which supports and mentors female entrepreneurs that are early stage and trying to scale their businesses, as well as our Entrepreneurs Access Network program, which supports Black and Latino entrepreneurs, and it's designed to equalize their access to resources and connections and help identify ways to provide capital to scale their businesses and we were thrilled. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that Detroit was one of the first cities in the country to establish this program. Wow. And next week, actually, we are hosting over 100 diverse entrepreneurs in Detroit from all across the country to bring them all together expose them to some of Detroit for many who have not been here.
Angie Kelly, it seems to me that Detroit is a good place to be an entrepreneur. Can you talk about the environment here and how encouraging you are and your company is and other companies like yours?
Absolutely. Detroit has grit and is just seen as a place where people can grow and thrive. And all the investments that people and corporations that are making in the city are truly making a difference. The investments that are being made in the brand in Detroit and Greater Michigan as a place where people want to live and work. I love when, I hire somebody and they're from out of state and they tell me why they choose Detroit or choose Michigan. And it's that grit all the opportunities and growth that they see here. But also, businesses are starting, creating their businesses in Michigan. They're moving to Michigan. They're growing in Michigan. And we've got fantastic talent here, right here in our region.
When somebody comes to you and they say, hey, I've got this idea or I've got a product or I know how to make something and I want to get started in business, what are some of the first things that you tell them to do?
Certainly build a strong team. I think that goes without saying. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs wear many hats on their own. We really try within our business accelerator programs, to provide access to resources and connections, to other entrepreneurs so they can share stories of lessons learned right on the front lines of how best to grow and scale their businesses. But certainly surrounding themselves with a great team and not feeling like they have to do everything themselves. You can't do everything yourself and you need a support team around you. And we, certainly try to help, round out those teams and provide connections with other entrepreneurs that can help them.
You've been part of Detroit for quite a while now. How are you feeling about this incredible resurgence that we're seeing in the city and around the city?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I love that, Detroit is being viewed as a place where businesses and people can just thrive. All eyes are going to be on the city this week with the NFL draft here. And as I mentioned, we're bringing in entrepreneurs ourselves next week to shine a spotlight on Detroit and on Michigan. I'm so inspired and just love the momentum that all of us are seeing in Detroit and in Greater Michigan.
You're the first female managing partner of EY in Detroit. Did you ever see yourself, as you're growing up, like, wow, someday down the road, I'm going to be in charge of a very important big company?
I always wanted to have access to leadership opportunities, but like I said, a career in professional service was not on my radar. And as a student, had a chance to be exposed to it and just loved the opportunities that it would afford me. I certainly, rose through the ranks and always really tried to step out of my comfort zone and try different opportunities. And found myself kind of dabbling in everything and getting involved in a lot of different, opportunities that the firm afforded me. It's not what I envisioned as a student in accounting that, I would have access and opportunity to be involved in just so many fantastic opportunities.
Did you have great mentors and do you like the idea of mentorship?
Absolutely. Our model is an apprenticeship model. And so, we have direct exposure to mentors and our performance reviews are, you know, part of it is how much we are mentoring and sponsoring others. And I love that that apprenticeship model is really built right into everything we do. It is so important to pay it forward and bring everybody up.
What kind of advice do you have for young men and women that are interested in professional services and maybe just starting out their careers?
Definitely just, you know, having the ability to pivot and adapt to change. I think we've all seen that over the last few years. But just keeping an open mind to any opportunities that come to you. But also having an attitude of gratitude. I think that is, you know, so important in today's world and everything that we do. And it's certainly important to me. I look to work with other leaders and with students that invest in relationships and make meaningful connections. And, you know, people that project confidence and are authentic.
Angie Kelly, the first female managing partner of EY, that's Ernst & Young LLP in Detroit. Thank you so much for your time today. And again, congratulations.
Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
You are listening to Women Who Lead. Coming up next, you'll meet the new head of Franco. We'll be back right after this. Listening to Women Who Lead, and I'm Ann Thomas. Franco, a Detroit-based integrated communications agency, has celebrated 60 years in business. They did this in January, and the company has a new owner. Her name is Tina Kozak. She's on the other end of the line, and she is one of our 2024 Women Who Lead honorees. Congratulations, Tina.
Anne, thank you so much. And it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Tina, tell us all about this. You're the owner. How cool is this?
Thanks. It is. It's very exciting. So definitely not new to the business, but yes, finally, kind of finally chipped away at that ownership, and it is ours. Very exciting. Been with the company 17 years, but it feels like a brand new day now that it's actually, in my hands.
And you took over from Dan Ponder, just a great, wonderful guy. Did
Absolutely.
You have mixed feelings, or how did this work out for you?
I left corporate. It was so many years ago, but it kind of comes back to the reason why, because I think I had, you know, by all accounts, a pretty great situation way back then. But I was missing two things, and it was I missed Detroit. I really missed being in the city. And I had this sort of entrepreneurial spark that I think I was born with. And I knew that I wouldn't really be able to satisfy that, you know, in a big corporate organization. So I came to Franco all of those years ago, really kind of feeding those two needs for myself. And over the years, it's just been so amazing to be able to work in the city, work alongside Dan and all of these other amazing teammates, grow the business, work with these clients that are doing just such important work in the region. So it certainly doesn't feel, it feels like something that I've always wanted. And in some, you know, some days it feels like it took a long time to get here. Other days it feels like it was just yesterday that I came into the Rensen and started working at Franco for the first time. Very, very excited about where we are now and where we're going.
And, you know, I worked with Dan on a lot of projects over the years, and I always admired him and considered him to be kind of a mentor for me. I just like the way he, you know, does business. How do you feel about him?
Absolutely. Well, he, even though Tony Franco founded the agency, we really view Dan as the founder in so many ways, or as a second founder, because he really instilled the team culture at Franco, the caring culture. He does business in a way that is smart and performs. We perform, but he does it in a way that is also just kind and caring and puts people first. And it's really built this team culture that we're now just taking and, you know, kind of caring for and making tweaks along the way to make it, you know, work and continue to work for the future. But Dan set us up with such a strong, strong foundation, not only on the business performance side, but on the, like, the values and the character side.
And very supportive of women.
Yes, very supportive.
So let's talk a little bit now about your goals. You're in charge. What are your plans? Can you tell us?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, we've really been working at a vision for the last 5 or 6 years, and it's, you know, coming closer and closer to fruition, I would say. And just like any good vision, you know, we modify it. We certainly weren't planning on a pandemic or on a new way of working, you know, kind of physically even, and challenges that clients just didn't have before.
Right.
So we're kind of adapting along the way. But we really modified our approach from just earned media, straight PR, to more integrated communications. And that, I think, has been one reason that we've grown in the last couple of years. So clients come looking to us more for strategy and how communications can actually move, like, needles in the organization beyond, like, we want to get, you know, we want to raise awareness. Okay, awareness for what? So we're trying to dig into the, what is the client's goal, and how do we put a couple of different pieces together in an integrated program that helps them get there? And our people are at the very center of that.
You know, maybe because I too am in the communications business, I think this, but I don't think I'm wrong when I say that to have a successful business, you have to have amazing communications.
Yeah, we would agree with you, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's how we get along so well.
Yes, exactly.
And I think it, you know, in that is, we believe that. We believe that a strong communications program can really impact the performance of an organization.
Yes.
And a business that believes that is a great fit for us. A business that sees communications as a box to check or kind of a necessary evil, especially when it comes to internal communications, those are the businesses that kind of come and go for us. We really have the most impact, and I think our clients that get the most, you know, feel the most rewarded working with us are those who really believe that communications can be a game changer.
That's a good point. How are you doing post-pandemic? What is your philosophy about working in the office, working at home, maybe a hybrid model?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. Well, we're doing really well. I'm so proud of our team, and I have been since that March in 2020 when we all left the office with a couple of things and said, oh gosh, we'll see each other in a couple of weeks. And
right.
I'll always remember, we're such a tight team. And I remember walking out with a group of folks, and we were like, oh, we're not going to see each other for a couple of weeks. We're really going to miss each other. And there was like this sort of parting, and everyone felt like the heartstrings were being pulled at a little bit. And I think that's when I knew, even before we, you know, got to our home offices, but that's when I knew this is going to work for us. This is absolutely going to work for us. This team is so bonded and our culture is so strong that we can be, you know, adaptable and work from where we need to work from, and be where we need to be. And we have. So we're very much hybrid. We're in the office 1 or 2 days a week, and we're wherever our clients need us to be, you know, because you probably
right.
see our team
yeah.
all over town.
Oh, yes.
And it's working. And some of our clients, you know, need us on site quite often, and others are out of the country or out of the state, and we've done everything virtually for a long time. But I think we're thriving in this environment. I am certainly not grateful for the pandemic, but I appreciate the opportunity to kind of shake things up. And I think it's given people even just a greater sort of a different energy and a better balance in a lot of ways. And I think companies that are moving along with it, their employees feel grateful and feel just more invested and more energized to do the work.
I think you're right about that. I bet your employees appreciate your approach.
I think they do. I really think they do. And it's shown in our retention and, you know, and I think it shows in the work that we do for the clients. We're very much a, and I don't apologize for this, I'm a employees first employer. Mm-hmm. And I think we always have been. And you, you know, mentioned Dan Ponder. And I think it's, you know, started at a, you know, at a point in history where maybe everyone wasn't putting their employees first, but we do and make decisions that work for the business, but that also put our employees at the forefront, because then they do the very best work right. for the clients, and then the clients are happy.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you take care of your employees, they'll take care of you, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What kind of advice do you have for young men, young women who are interested in the communications world, communications businesses?
I think it's, you know, being really curious and listening, you know, consuming the news and paying attention to kind of how things happen. That, you know, before we got into this industry, right, we didn't understand how things got into the news or how things got into sort of even the, you know, the regional, you know, conversation. So I think it's like paying attention to that and just being really curious. We talk about curiosity and a curious mindset, and I think that's something that you need to live with, you know, forever. I hope that I always feel curious about everything, but especially early on, you know, just kind of soaking in as much as you can, and asking lots of whys.
That's a good advice. You know, communications has changed from when you and I first got started in the business. Can you talk about some of these changes, especially the addition of social media, that whole form of communicating?
Yeah, absolutely. So much. I mean, when I thought about coming into PR, you know, we had the books that had the tiny, tiny thin pages, the Bacon yes. books that had all of the reporters, you know, in any industry, in any region, in any state. And, like that's who worked there each year. And that was like the Bible. And now things just move, you know, moment to moment. And it's not, you know, this, you know, it's not just your traditional media who are telling stories, your consumers are telling stories. And there is just, there's a lot of opportunity, I think, that creates for businesses and certainly for communicators to just do better storytelling. And I think consumers of news and of, you know, products are much more savvy now and have much higher expectations for a brand. And so it's our job as communicators to deliver on those expectations.
How do you help companies make sure that the information they put out is accurate? And, you know, nowadays we have to deal with all these bots and all these different things on social media where some people just aren't sure. How do you work with companies and advise them to make sure that what is out there is accurate and truthful?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to a business has to care that the information is truthful,
right.
And, you know, has to be committed to communications can make or break a business. So if, you know, if you have a business owner who feels like, oh, well, it doesn't matter that, you know, there's all of this negative stuff in our social because, you know we have a relationship with the client. There's, you know, there's not a lot we as an agency of communicators can do. So on one hand, it's the mindset. And, you know, helping business leaders understand the importance of the accuracy of information, you know, and then it is just very sort of studious and round the clock listening and aggregating, lots of fact checking. And sometimes, you know, you want to be first and you want to get things out, but it's really much more important to be accurate. It takes a lot longer to go back and course correct something that got out there that was wrong than, you know, than just waiting and getting it right the first time. So it's not always perfect. And because there are all these channels, it sometimes makes it easier too, to, you know, to do course correcting or to do updating. But we want to put sort of what is accurate and truthful at the forefront and work with businesses who share that value. And I would say starting there is the most important thing.
And Tina Kozak, final question. As the new owner of Franco, you must just absolutely love all of the great things going on in Detroit.
Oh, my gosh. yes. Mm-hmm. And the community is such an important part of who Franco is. And so whether we're working directly or indirectly on things like, you know, the NFL draft or just all of the development, all of the excitement, we absolutely love promoting the city, the people here, the stories. Whether we're, you know, on board working for an organization or not, we are the biggest Detroit boosters and I think, you know, cheerleaders that you'll find. And being headquartered in the city for 60 years, I think really gives us the authenticity to play that role, to be that reputation spreader sort of for the region.
Tina Kozak, Franco owner and CEO. And again, congratulations. She is one of our 2024 Women Who Lead honorees.
Thanks, Ann.
Coming up next on Women Who Lead, Barbara McQuaid, the former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She has a new book out. We'll learn all about it right after this. Listening to Women Who Lead, I'm Ann Thomas, and I am here now with Barbara McQuaid. She's the former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, a University of Michigan Law School professor, and she has a new book out called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. She's also our 2014 Women Who Lead honoree. Barb, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Ann.
I want to talk about this book. I know it is already extremely popular, but why has disinformation become such a big problem in America?
Well, certainly we've had, you know, propaganda and spin and even outright lies to us from politicians throughout the duration of our nation's history. But I think the problem is particularly acute right now for two main reasons. One is technology. Social media allows anyone to send a message instantly to reach millions of people, and they can do so anonymously. So that is one source, I think, of a lot of disinformation. And I think the other problem that we are facing at this moment is extreme polarization, culture wars, I think deliberate strategies by both parties to appeal to their bases and ignore the swing voters of the middle the way they used to, has reached this level where people are more aligned with their party than they are with any particular issue. And so I think it is causing many people, even those who don't fall for the lies that they read online, to choose tribe over truth. And so I think that's why we find ourselves at this moment.
This book, Barbara McQuaid, is very thorough, extremely well written. What made you decide to take this so personally and do something about it?
You know, this is a topic, Ann, that I've been teaching at Michigan Law School since 2018. I teach a course in national security law. And as a prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office, my area of practice and focus was national security law. And over the years, during that time, you know, I saw the threat to national security evolve from Al-Qaeda to ISIS to China and Russia and cyber attacks. And now I think the biggest threat to national security is actually disinformation coming from within our own country. And so it's a topic I've really been studying in my class and with my teaching and in my own research and reading since 2018. And I thought, you know, what I want to do is write a book that's accessible to ordinary people, readable, so that people can identify disinformation, see these tactics for what they are. And I think when we can name them and identify them, we are less likely to be susceptible to them.
What are some examples of how disinformation is actually hurting our country?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, I mean, one, democracy, and I'm very concerned about the upcoming election. We have seen, through Russia in 2016, send false claims on social media, pretending to be members of various groups with false personas online, trying to influence voters in terms of who to vote for or who not to vote for, trying to dampen voter turnout, and undermining public confidence in the outcome of elections. Just this February, there was an example of robocalls using AI-generated recordings that sounded like the voice of Joe Biden, urging voters to stay home from the polls. Now, it was an inconsequential primary because Joe Biden was running
without any opponent on the other side. And so it didn't really make a difference in the outcome of that election. But one worries certainly about the impact something like that could have, regardless of which side it's on in the November elections. And whether it's at the top of the ticket or somewhere in a local race, that could have a huge impact on the outcome. And I think this idea of just undermining confidence in elections altogether, you know, that elections are fixed or rigged or we can't rely on the outcome, I think is an effort to cause people to become frustrated and disengaged in the political process altogether and to not vote. And that's very harmful, I think, to democracy.
Why do you think so many people are comfortable with disinformation?
I think we have reached a point in our history where people care more about winning than they care about civic virtue. You know, I think that, as Thomas Jefferson once said, democracy depends on an informed electorate. And instead, what we find today is a disinformed electorate. But as you say, many people don't care. What they really care about is their vision of America or winning or their tribe. We see ourselves as left and right and nowhere in between. You know, you and I are of similar vintage, and perhaps you recall, as I do, when I was in college and first formulating my views on various issues, I thought about issues on an individual basis, right? I thought one thing about affirmative action and maybe another about abortion and one thing about guns and maybe another about immigration. And now there seems to be this need to line up with duty, with your own party aligned on every issue. And that's what I mean by this sort of tribal idea as opposed to you know, thinking independently for yourself. But I don't think that's any way to run a country.
You know, the other thing that I think we're seeing is that people are very quick to label you. So you may feel one way about a particular subject, and automatically there's a label.
Yeah, such a good point. And I think it creates an incentive for people who don't want to be labeled as something or other to line up and signal their virtue and say, sure, I'm on the side, you know, whatever it's, I'm on the red team, I'm on the blue team. See, I agree with this or I agree with that. And I think that's so damaging. You know, we've seen it with, you know, Liz Cheney being isolated from her party for daring to speak out against the election events of January 6th. And Mitt Romney, Justin Amash, other people, if you dare speak out and are not consistent and have political purity, you might be excommunicated from your party. And so it creates this pressure to line up on guns or whatever the issue may be so that you are not accused of or labeled of being somebody who's not part of your party. But the problem with that, of course, Anne, is that anything we've ever achieved in this country comes through compromise.
Right.
Politics is the art of compromise. And so if we want to get anything done in Congress or our legislatures, we need people to be able to compromise to move forward. And so that demand for political purity is really undermining our ability to achieve any kind of social progress.
So, Barbara McQuaid, how can we combat disinformation? What are some tips that you have to help us get out of this cycle?
Well, some of the things I think will require governmental work, but of course, in a democracy, we the people have that power. So I think there's some things that we can do to regulate social media. I'm not talking about content regulation, which might run afoul of the First Amendment, but things like regulating the algorithms that can push certain content toward us that manipulates us, content designed to outrage us. Or we could regulate social media in the way they scrape our personal data and sell it to data brokers who in turn sell it to commercial enterprises or political consultants. I think we could eliminate bots online. You know, these are these artificial intelligence-generated fake accounts that look like real people and pick fights with you if you dare say anything of any controversy. Or they amplify false claims and make it look more popular than it is or expand the reach. So those are some things I think we can do on social media. I also think we could improve our own media literacy to build resilience against disinformation. We're never going to eliminate all of it, but if we have the skills to be able to detect false claims, I think we can do a much better job, you know, looking for a second source of information, relying not just on the headline in a story, looking to see whether data supports conclusions that are being drawn by, you know, so-called studies. And I think varying your news outlets, you know, looking not just at one news source or reading not just one news source, but finding an abundance of news sources, because some may be promoting disinformation, but others may be just, you know, using a particular editorial discretion to choose which stories they choose to report, and you might be missing out on some important news by secluding yourself with one news source. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do to defeat disinformation, but we need to make sure that we're committed to truth, because that is the engine of democracy.
You know, to this point, I do think we all kind of need to realize that we do enjoy our echo chambers, and it might be a little bit uncomfortable to step out, but you need to.
Yes. I just heard someone this morning listening to a podcast say, our listeners won't want to hear this, but, yes. And then she described something that was perhaps contrary to the target audience of the podcast. We can't be afraid of it. I'm glad she wasn't. But, you know, that viewers or listeners will turn it off. Fox News found that after the election, when they reported that Arizona had gone for Joe Biden, that they lost viewers. You know, people don't want to hear it. We put our hands over our ears. I don't believe it. It can't be true if it's bad. We have to be willing to accept that there are some good facts and some bad facts. You know, as a trial lawyer, I had to learn my case, whether, you know, there were facts that supported my theory of the case, and sometimes there were bad facts in the case. And I couldn't run away from them. I had to confront them head on and then use them to engage and sharpen the debate. Yes, these bad facts exist, but let me also tell you about these good facts and why I believe in the end my position should prevail. That's how good debate and critical thinking is supposed to work. If we ignore bad facts, then we're not really making the best choice.
You know, I love when you talk about you yourself being attacked with disinformation online. Tell our listeners a little bit about that. It's amazing.
Yes. You know, it is sort of ironic that if you write a book about disinformation, you get attacked with disinformation. But I've seen attacks, and they seem coordinated. So clearly, you know, this is either programmed as bots or some coordinated effort. But there have been people accusing me of censorship online. Of course, you know, that's the big one. Anytime you suggest that speech should be limited in any way, or accuse me of wanting to be the disinformation police, you know, and I think suggesting this idea that there's no such thing as truth. And, you know, that's just nonsense and garbage. But it is kind of ironic. But I try to... I don't address them individually, but push back when they make false claims and to debunk false claims. But I always do it politely, and I don't accuse anybody of anything. But I might say something like, there seems to be some confusion about my position on the First Amendment. I most certainly cherish the First Amendment as one of our most important rights in democracy. But that doesn't mean we get to say anything we want to say whenever we want to say it, wherever we want to say it. There are reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on our First Amendment free speech rights, and we need to embrace those as well as our right to say things.
The book is called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barbara McQuaid, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you, Anne. Great to be with you.
And I'm Ann Thomas. Thank you for listening to Women Who Lead, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.